Christmas.
Okay, good. All right, so it's the 28th of April. April is almost over. And then May, boom, April has that lull. It sort of slows down. And then May, boom, disappears. So we have chapter 9 is due. Turn it in. Chapter 10, I haven't even given it out to you yet. I'll give it out to you today. But it's supposedly due on Thursday, but we'll make it next Thursday. It's the calculations for the worksheets that we've done, and we'll do again today because exam number 4 is this Thursday. Sorry, Yvette, to scare Yvette. But this Thursday is exam number 4. And you already know pretty much you know what my exams look like. There will be 3 questions on hybrid securities. I will show them to you. So chapters 9 and 10, make sure you studied that material from chapter 9 that we skimmed over, right? Everyone nod your heads yes. You've gone online, make me feel good, okay. And chapter 18, I'll show you the 3 questions. No calculations from chapter 18, but the bond calculations from chapter 10, the worksheets, we have some extras. We'll go over it again today. We didn't go over number 2 yet. So after class today, or maybe we'll get done early, I'm not sure. And there'll be 2 stock calculations, the constant perpetual and the discounted cash flow as before. Bring a Scantron. You can bring your stock and bond formula sheets. I'll have extras. And in addition, 1 page of notes. So bring a calculator also. Questions? What? This next class. Right, Joel? There you go. So next class, and again, we'll review after class also. So we'll first take a look. We already talked about this. Any questions at all before we get started? Anybody got a good joke? How about a really? Yes, let's hear.
Loosely religious.
I don't know. Let's.
So there's a girl sitting at Saturday school, Catholic school. She's falling asleep. Well, she is asleep, and the teacher wakes her. Their name is Anna. She's sleeping, and the teacher calls her and asks her, Anna, who's the creator of the universe? And then a kid behind her pokes her, and she wakes up and says, Holy God. Later on throughout the class, she falls asleep again. She falls asleep again, and then the teacher picks on her again. Who is the Son of God? The kid pokes her again. She wakes
Jesus
up and
Christ.
Says, Jesus Christ. She falls asleep one last time, and the teacher picks on her and says, what did he say after 17 children? The kid pokes on her one last time. She says,
that's
touch me with that thing again, and I'll break it in half.
Okay. Yeah, I was a little worried there. You know, don't want to create a hostile environment for religious folks. Okay, great. So first things first, let's take a look at the 3 questions that are going to be on the exam for, and I'll show you at the end of class too, for hybrid securities. We went through these very quickly last Thursday. What are preferred stock? Right. They are in between. There's the term preferred. I mean, it has a prior claim over the common stockholders, but after the bond investors. So shareholders get paid after bond investors, but before common stock in case of default. Preferred stocks or bonds that can be exchanged for shares of common stock are called convertibles. Think of the car, right? Real sexy, but not really. And the type of preferred stock that specifies any dividends and arrears that must be paid to preferred shareholders before dividends can be restored to common stockholders is known as cumulative. So these are the 3 things I want you to know about hybrid securities. Got it? Well, I'll show it to you again after class, okay? I'll show it to you again so you can write it down. I'll even email it to all of you if you want me to, okay? Because these are the 3 things out of bits of chapter 18 in the lecture that I want you to know. All right, let's get started on chapter 11 because this is so... Oh, by the way, I have to pass out the assignments for the bond. And I apologize. I'll put this back on the screen before we get started. Some of you are feverishly writing it down. Okay. Here is the assignment for chapter 10, and it is essentially just the same as the worksheet that we did. Well, 2 worksheets. We didn't do worksheet number 2 yet. There are a few, couple problems at the end that make you think. We didn't really do anything like them, but you have all the information you do, plus the plus you have to understand what a zero coupon bond is, which I want you to know. Make sure you know what that means. And so I'm going to make you think, and some people hate being made to think. They just want to be told what to do. to do. But here, pass these around here. Here is the worksheet from chapter 18 from Preferred. And this one is an optional assignment. There's an optional assignment on the back of chapter 18. It is the easiest 5 points all semester long. So do turn it in. The online students keep writing me back saying, are you sure this is all we're supposed to do? They're ahead of you. They're ahead of you, so they had to do everything. It's not optional for them. Okay. So, again, I'll put it back. I'll send it out. Send me an email. I'll email it to everybody. Let's get started on chapter 11, because this is very cool. I had a class once in college where this is one of my math, I was a math major, and this guy was brilliant, genius, but nobody understood what the hell was going on. And towards the end of the semester, we were all still pretty confused about what was going on. And he said to us, well, today we're going to tie it all together. We're going to basically wrap up what we've done. And I know many of you are still confused, but hopefully after this lecture, you will have a better understanding of what we've been doing. And of course, none of us knew what that was. After it's done, we looked at each other like, no. Okay. No, that way.
Oh, that way.
That way. So hopefully that won't be you. Hopefully that won't be the case here. Because what? Now that we have gone through our serious and rigorous discussions of stocks and bonds, it is time to tie it all together, so to speak, and see the interrelationship of these guys and how they, what's going on. Some of them don't have anything on the back. Some of them do. Some of them have something on the back. What is this? Does anybody have anything on your back of yours? Okay, then it wasn't supposed to be then. I apologize. I think I changed my mind, right, because I did it twice. Because this one, the very first one, where is the very first one? I don't know. Yeah, see, I put that on the back, and I said, no, don't do that. That's the next chapter. I don't want to get you confused. So everybody got chapter 11? There's nothing on the back? Okay, one more. Okay, give one to Lily. You got next one? Oh, here. Okay. All right, so diversification and risky asset allocation. So we're going to tie it all together. What does it mean? What are we talking about here? Diversification. You know what that means. Spreading your investments across a number of asset classes to eliminate some, but not all, of the risks investing. Have you heard the saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket? It's good. You know, I agree with it. There's other people who say, no. Put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. Watch it fall. I don't know if I agree with that. It's attributed to Mark Twain, probably erroneously. Every time you see something is attributed to Mark Twain, you have to be careful, because a lot of stuff that's really smart and witty is often attributed to him erroneously. Diversification has been one of the best methods to reduce risk. Look, folks, over the last 12, well, from 89 to 2013, here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different asset classes. And it shows you that in any one year, you really don't know who's going to be the leader. U.S. company stocks, global small company, international, outside the United States, emerging markets, U.S. bonds, international bonds. And there are some times when an asset class just goes on a tear. Between 95 and 98, U.S. stocks just were on fire. And I remember people back in 96 saying how overvalued the market was. And I thought, well, you know, it was kind of scared me. But look at what happened after that. You know, 3 years after 96, 7, 8, and 9, even though, you know, emerging markets exploded in 1999. So when you hear people say that stocks are overvalued today, I always go, well, I think they're richly valued. They're not cheap. They're certainly not the where they were at 2000. It was just insane. So I think we could have the U.S. stocks did well 2013. Now we got to get 2014 data here. But look at the emerging markets. Look at them. But there's a reason why they're sometimes called the sub-emerging markets. It's volatile, isn't it? But not once, folks, not once did short-term cash investments beat the pack. This is the thing that I think, you know, people will say, oh, you know, I got my money in cash right now. I'm waiting for the market to fall. I think it's a bad time to invest. Does history say that it's a good idea? I don't think so. I mean, you might think it is. You might feel bad because the market seems overvalued. But the truth, or at least the history, tells us that cash is not the place to be. Now, if you need your money in 3, 6, 9 months, are you going to put it into emerging markets? No, it's got to go into a savings account, money market, CDs. But if you have a long-term perspective, this is the worst place to be. Questions, thoughts? Make sense? Yeah? Okay, now, how do we measure risk? That's the kicker. We've come full circle. Way back in chapter 1, we introduced the tug of war between risk and return. We saw how the higher the average annual return, the higher the standard deviation and its companion measure variance from the average annual total return. We have studied the major financial asset classes. We studied mutual funds, stocks, bonds, cash, short-term investments, and we discussed the risks and returns of each. Return is easy to measure. How much money did you start with? How much money did you make? How long did it take you? But risk is very difficult to measure. It's even more harder to anticipate. 2008 and 9, I was sure the market was going to fall 10, 20% or so. I was sure. I didn't think it was going to fall 50, 60%. Variance and standard deviation. Variance and its more useful companion, standard deviation, tell us how much an asset class will vary from the expected return. These measures are readily available from the investment community. Just look them up. The book teaches you how to calculate them. I don't care if you know how to calculate them. That's for your statistics class. The numbers ain't pretty. For any randomly selected stock on the New York Stock Exchange, the standard deviation is almost 50%. What does that mean? That means the average annual return is whatever it is, and 10%, 9%, 12%, and the expected return will be plus or minus 50% of that. So even the companies that are the most stable stocks are going to vary up and down close to 50% from their average annual return. So how can we reduce the variance? In other words, how do we reduce the risk? The answer is to diversify. If you simply just add one stock to your portfolio, then the standard deviation goes from around 50% down to 37%. If you add 10 stocks, or you add 8 more stocks, you go to 10 stocks, it goes down to about 24%. 20 stocks, 21.5%, and so on. Diversifying our stock portfolio reduces our risk substantially, as measured by reduced variance and standard deviation, which we already have determined are not perfect measures. So here is a graph. No, this isn't the graph. The graph's on the next page. But here's a table showing you the number of stocks in your portfolio rising, the return, deviation, the standard deviation reducing. But what do we see once we get about 40, 50, 100, 200? What's happening here? There's a limit, right? There's a law of diminishing returns. And here's the graph. And math folks will know. What is this called?
What's slope?
This is the slope, and then it reaches a limit.
Decay.
decay. It's exponential decay. And what happens is there's a limit. This is the limit. It'll never get to this. It'll just keep getting, you add more and more and more stocks, and you'll get closer and closer and closer, but you'll never really get there. There is a limit to which diversification can reduce your risk in any given asset class. In this case, we're talking about stocks. And why is that? The word is correlation. Have you heard it before? Correlation is the tendency of the returns of two assets to move together. And the reason diversification works is because of imperfect correlation. Imperfect correlation, meaning they don't go together perfectly, is the key reason why diversification reduces portfolio risk as measured by the portfolio standard deviation. No two investment returns will be exactly the same. I mean, that just makes sense. Every company's different. I mean, some in the same sector will move together. If oil drops from $110 a barrel down to $50, you can expect the oil companies to fall, and it's exactly what happened. But no two companies will do exactly the same. And positively correlated assets tend to move up and down together, whereas negatively correlated assets tend to move in opposite directions. So if I'm a little bit confusing you now, let's take a look at what's called the correlation coefficient to really confuse you. Because this is part of statistics. And again, you don't have to learn how to calculate it. You just look it up. You go online. That's all they ask you to do, is to go look up the correlation coefficient. Look up the standard deviation, and then I ask you to look up alpha and beta and a few other things, but you don't have to know that. And the correlation coefficient runs from -1, -100%, to 0, to +1, +100%. So mathematicians use the variable R for the correlation coefficient. Don't ask me why. So here are two investments. And these two investments are perfectly correlated. Now, one is a little more volatile in that goes up higher and it goes down lower, but they move exactly the same. So the correlation coefficient would be 100%, 1. These two investments are perfectly negatively correlated. So the correlation coefficient is -100%. The one goes up, the other goes down. The one comes back up, the other one goes down. Are you with me? And then this graph I don't think is very good, but it's trying to show you zero correlation. They just move randomly. One goes up, the other one stays the same or goes down or goes up. Or you just don't know. You don't know. You can't expect them to be correlated with one another. And that just makes sense, doesn't it? The word correlation. Correlation, you know, how well do they move together? So how does this answer our question about why diversification can only reduce by so much the risks of owning stocks? Although stocks are not perfectly correlated, no two companies are going to move exactly the same, they are positively correlated enough so that stocks in general tend to move in the same direction. And you know this intuitively already because you hear about people talking about how's the market doing? How's the stock market doing? That is why we often refer to stock investments as a whole as the stock market. Even though at any given time, some companies are doing well, others are doing poorly, and many are simply chugging along as they always have. And we said did I tell you the 5-stock rule of thumb that the NASC gives you? You buy 5 stocks. One does poorly, one does really well, and the other 3 just basically follow the market. Excuse me. Okay. Darn. By adding more stocks to my portfolio, I'm not going to reduce my risk to 0 because the stock market as a whole moves up and down. That's still too much risk for me. I think I'm going to stick to bonds. You are a very conservative, not politically conservative, risk-averse investor, and you don't like the volatility of stocks. Therefore, you decide to place all your investments into bonds. I want to be able to sleep well. You accept the lower return from the bonds in exchange from the lower risk of the stocks. I'm sorry, did I say it right? You accept the lower returns from the bonds in exchange for the lower risk of the bonds relative to the stocks. bad idea. If you're a long-term investor, that was a bad idea. And you go, why? Wouldn't it make sense that bonds would be less volatile than stocks? The reason is because, like stocks, bonds are positively correlated with themselves. They tend to do well and not do well the same way that stocks do well and not do well. But the stocks are more tied to the economy, and bonds are more tied to interest rates, which means that they're, you know, fairly tied to the economy, because interest rates tend to go up as the economy does really well, and stocks go up when the economy does really well. What happens when interest rates go up to bonds? What happens to their bond prices? They go down. So it turns out that they are negatively, in general, not always, 2008, they both went down at the same time. But when bonds go up, it's because interest rates are falling. That's usually because the economy is not doing well. The demand for money is not doing well. And so stocks are not doing well. And likewise, when the economy is doing well, stocks are roaring, bonds are like, or they're falling because interest rates are rising. Here is a graph that shows what happens when you have a 100% stock portfolio and a 100% bond portfolio, and then start to mix the two. If you start with 100% bonds, you're going to expect to have the highest return, but you're also going to expect to have the highest volatility. That makes sense, right? As we add more and more bonds, what we see is the return going down, but we also see the volatility, the standard deviation going down. But what happens is there's an inflection point. There's a point where as we continue to reduce our stock exposure and add our bond exposure, not only does our return continue to go down, but now our standard deviation starts going back up again because bonds are correlated to themselves. Make sense? So it's counterintuitive, and we made mention of this back in Chapter 4 when we put the stock mutual funds over here, the riskiest, and then we put the bond mutual funds over here, and then we put the balance fund as less risky than the bond or the stock funds. So here's that graph in table form. And instead of using percent, you start with 1, so it's 100%, and going down to 0%, and bonds starting at 0 and going up to 100%. And this table is just showing you the graph on the previous slide. Our expected return is highest, and as we reduce our stock exposure and add our bond exposure, we see the return going down. Well, that's what we expect. Of course, right now, are you going to get 6% from your bonds right now? 3 or 4 is more likely. And then we see the standard deviation going down until we finally hit that inflection point around here or so, 30% or so, 35%. And then the standard deviation starts going back up again. What a bad deal that is. A combination of stocks and bonds actually created a portfolio with less risk while earning you more return than just bonds. If you are seeking less risk, it not only pays to diversify within an asset class, it pays to diversify among asset classes. This same kind of relationship occurs with domestic and foreign stocks and bonds, although less now than in the past, and certainly with real estate. And many people say, well, why don't you invest in real estate? Well, I said most people are going to. They're going to buy a home, so they already have some real estate. And real estate, as we'll see in a couple of weeks, is a real PETA. I told you about the PETA factor for mutual funds. Pain in the... Well, I am here to tell you, vouchsafe, that investing in real estate is a... Ooh, and you want to strangle one of your tenants. You want to take your hand and put them around their neck and squeeze them until their eyes pop out. By the way, diversification is still not a guarantee of positive results. No diversification scheme worked well in 2008, unless your idea of diversification was treasury bonds and money market accounts, right? Because the treasuries actually went up, flight to quality, and money markets didn't lose money, even though a couple of them did. Federal Reserve came in and saved them. We have a name for choosing the appropriate mix for an investor. It is called asset allocation. Have you heard this term? Asset allocation. Much is written, much is discussed about asset allocation, that our asset allocation mutual funds, which are not the same, with equal sign no, as balance funds, depending on the different funds. Asset allocation means how much do you have in stocks? How much do you have in bonds? How much of each stock type? How much of each bond type? For decades, the rule of thumb was to subtract your age from 100. This was the rule of thumb for decades. You take 100 and subtract your age. So let's say you're 40 years old. You should have 60% in stocks and 40% in bonds. Does that make sense? And obviously, as you get older, you're going to reduce your bond exposure. Which you millennials, that means 100 minus 20, you should have 80% in stocks and 20% in bonds. I think it's ridiculous. And notice that the number is going up. Why? Because people are living far longer. It just doesn't make, in my personal opinion, everyone's different, obviously, but in my personal opinion, you look at history, you look at the world falls apart, doesn't matter anyway, and if something comes along that's better than capitalism, I'll be happy to take a look at it, but you know, so far, nothing so far has been any better than capitalism. And it really makes sense for younger folks to be fully invested in stocks. Now, they got to learn that volatility is going to be there. But, of course, if you keep a long-term perspective, it's your friend because now you're buying shares at a lower price. Make sense? Make sense, yeah? And so some people say, this is ridiculous. Stick with stocks. Learn that the volatility is just part of the deal and have a long-term perspective. So here's an example of asset allocation. You're 25 years old. Maybe you're 35 years old. You use 110 instead of 100. And you say, I'm going to put 25% of my money into bonds. I'm going to put 75% into stocks. And then within the bond portfolio, 15,000 of that, 15%, you got $100,000 to invest. High-grade corporates and governments, 5,000 high yield. Another word, distressed. Speculative or junk. That's what it is. Double B or below. And then 5,000 outside the United States in global bonds. 75%, 75,000 stocks. Growth in income domestic. Global growth in income. Aggressive growth. Notice my favorite is still growth in income. Aggressive growth, international, and small companies. You like that? You like it? It's yours. You can use it. or if you get a well-heeled client that says, oh, I have an extra $100,000 to invest. How will you do that for me? There you go. You don't have to tell them you got it from me. Some of the same advisors that suggest asset allocation also suggest a technique of rebalancing. Every year or every 6 months, don't do it more than that, you check to see if your percentages are still in balance. For example, maybe it's been a banner stock year. And so now your portfolio looks like this. Bonds have maybe been flat or gone down, or maybe they just did 2 or 3%. But stocks have done 20, 30%. Now your portfolio is out of balance. You were looking for a 60-40 balance, and so you're now a little bit out of balance, 70-30. So what do? You sell some stocks, buy some bonds to bring you down in the stock world, up in the bond world, more into balance. Does that make sense? It's called rebalancing. That's a tough one. And why is it cool? Because it forces you to do the right thing. Stocks are doing well. Do you want to sell? You see your stock portfolio doing really well. Do you want to sell? Hell no. You're like, wait a minute, I wanna stay, this is fun. Bonds are doing not so well. You wanna buy bonds? Likewise, if stocks have tanked and bonds have done well, do you wanna sell your bonds and buy more stocks? No, because stocks are going down. So this forces you to do the thing that we tell everybody they should do, but very few people actually do, and that's buy low, sell high. Makes sense? It's really quiet in here, and I'm wondering if it's because I'm going over your head, or it was just because I know this stuff already, Pam. You've been beating it in our heads all semester long. Many advisors suggest that retirees shed the bulk of their stock investments in favor of bonds and cash investments. The only problem with this, dear students, is that people are living much, much longer. The statistic that I've read from a reliable source is that a 50-year-old today has a 50-50 chance of living to see 100 years old. Now, you millennials, 100 should be a whole lot more percentage. You should, I think of it like a car. 40 years ago, if you got 100,000 miles out of a car, that was pretty darn good. But now, if you don't get 100,000 miles out of a car, what the hell did you do to it? Unless you bought a Fiat, maybe. Okay. I mean, the cars are so much better built than they were that 100,000 miles, you're just getting started. And that should be the case with humans, assuming you don't keep drinking those sugary fizzy waters with the brown crayon stuck in it and keep eating lots of meat and smoke, and you should live a long time. And so as you near retirement, start migrating your investments from stocks to bonds, but don't give up on stocks entirely. I shouldn't tell you this, but this is what I think of stocks and bonds. I don't know if it makes any sense because people look at me strange when I say it, but I think of stocks like baseball and bonds like football. Look at the baseball diamond. Is there any limit to how far you can hit the ball? The lines go off into infinity, right? Football, it's a square. Well, it's a rectangle. And you go out of bounds, you're out, right? If you go out of bounds, you can't come back in. Have you noticed that in the game? You're not allowed to come back in. And so bonds are fixed. They will never do better than you know, except if interest rates fall precipitously. Then, yeah, you're going to do a little bit better. But it's got to be that the stock market's got to beat the bond market over time. It has to be that way. Because if it doesn't, that means the economy is really tanked and we're scrounging for beetle grubs and eating moths. Have you heard moth soup is pretty good? I haven't tried it yet. I've tried chapulines. The crickets are very good. In Oaxaca, they're very good. And so if the companies that are paying those bonds are falling into the toilet, they're not going to be able to pay them. And if the tax revenues are falling behind because the economy is falling, the municipalities and eventually the treasury, but that's not going to happen. That's the last one, the last bastion to fall. So stocks have got to do better than bonds. The key is to be able to deal with the volatility. Questions, thoughts, ideas? Do you have any idea what I'm talking about, or you think I'm crazy? You're right, I might be crazy. Okay, so what we're going to take a look at is three portfolios. In retirement, dear students, in retirement. But we see stocks versus bonds versus balanced. So here is a total large company stocks. I think that's the S&P 500, U.S. bonds. I think this is the Barclays, now called, no, it used to be called Lehman Brothers, now it's Barclays. And then here's a 60-40, and that is a reason why we like to see balanced funds to be 60-40. Gives you that growth from the stocks with the ballast from the stability of the bonds. And notice that only one time from 87 to 2013 did the mix win. Only one time. It was either the stock portfolio or the bond portfolio. Having a balanced portfolio means that you almost never have the best returns in any one year. However, it also means you will very rarely ever have the worst returns in any year. Do you like good offense or do you like good defense? In addition, although it is very unlikely that you will not equal or surpass an all-stock portfolio, your balanced portfolio, whether it's through a balanced mutual fund or you do it with stocks and bonds, should do much better than an all-bond portfolio. But you already know what I'm going to say, right? Any guarantees of that? No, other than my personal belief that stocks have to do better than bonds over the long term, or we in deep, deep kimchi. So now, let's go to the website and take a look. Whoa, where's chapter 11? There it is. Where is it? What happened to chapter 11? There it is. Okay, I'm sorry. Did I take a joke? The numbers go in strange order, so I get confused. Okay, so here are bonds in retirement. Okay. Bingo. This is, you remember the hypothetical illustrations? Here's the scary part. Be afraid. Be very afraid. This is a bond port. This is a sample bond mutual fund. And say you've accumulated $200,000 in your 401k or your Roth IRA, whatever it is. Now you're ready to stop accumulating. Now you're ready to start taking the money out. And so what, can you see that? Daniel, would you hit the lights down on the right-hand side, down twice, on the right-hand side? On the right, yeah, down twice. One more. Okay, thank you. Okay, good, good. Okay, here's the idea. This is what they say. You start with your $200,000 nest egg, and you're going to start taking 4% out. That's the magic number that you'll hear people say, although other people say, ah, it's ridiculous. Oh, there's lots of different ways. But let's start with the very common. You start taking 4% out, and then every year you increase that amount by 3%. No, we're not talking 4, 7, 10, no. The initial amount that you put out, that you took out, you're going to increase 3%. Inflation, 2, 3%. So you start the first year, well, this is only, 5,000. I think it's because we started on April 1st. We started April 1st, so that's why this is lower, because it's only 9 months. But then 8,160, 8,400, 8,600, 8,900, 9,200, 9,500. It's growing with inflation. And so the bond portfolio producing about 4, 5, 6% is basically staying similar. It's gone up a little bit. It's gone up a little bit throughout the 90s. And it's gone up even more when interest rates started falling precipitously. And it's doing pretty darn well until 2008 when you go from 265,000 down to 222, which is an unusual event, but that happens when interest rates fall and rise, or people dump their bonds because they're so afraid that the world is going to end like 2008. But then we start recovering, and our bond portfolio has actually held up pretty darn well. Remember, we've gone from 62 years old to 82 years old, or maybe you guys, 92 years old to 102. We've gotten $214,000 of income, and our portfolio is still worth $232. So, what do you think? Would you be happy with that? I ain't. Okay, there's the graph, and it shows what's happening, and there's 2008. And coming back, and now notice it dipped a little bit as interest rates went up. So what I like to think of is, well, I'm going to, probably not, but I'm going to keep all my money in the stock market because I'm going to live a long time. I tell my wife she has to live at least to 100 and some years because I want to live to 100, and she's a little older than me. I always suggest to people that they marry somebody who is older than them because they will always be older than they are. She's got to live to at least 103 because I want to live to 100. Okay, so we're starting with an all-stock portfolio. $200,000, we're going to do the exact same thing. We're going to increase it start with 4% and then increase it 3% every year. But we're going to deal with the volatility, even in retirement. And we started at a very good time. 1995, the market went up 5 years in a row. And by the end of 2000, we had 467,000. But then, ouch, right? Between March of 2000 and April and October 2002, we went down, well, the market went down about 50%. This mutual fund happened to hold up a whole lot better. But still, you're now 75, maybe 80, and you see your portfolio go from 467 down to 364. What do you do? Have a heart attack? You panic? Because here, 2003, and then 2007, we're up to 600,000. 2008, a bolt of lightning out of the sky. The world's going to end. The Antichrist has been elevated. That's what people said. They're still saying. Did you hear Michelle Bachmann a couple of weeks ago? Said that Obama has set up the time for the rapture. Okay, fine. And then we lived through that. We survived. We didn't have a heart attack. And now the last 6-7 years have been pretty darn good. We still got that same $200,000. Maybe we're feeling flush. We're taking more out. But is the graph going to be the same? Hell no. The grab is far more volatile. First, we almost had a heart attack here. This definitely sent us to the hospital. But at least we can pay the hospital bill. All right, now, what happens if we mix the two? What happens if we have a mixture of bonds and stocks? So it's the same two mutual funds, but now we started with $100,000 of each. What happens is we don't get as good a return. We only got 8%, and our portfolio is now better than the bonds, but nowhere near as good as the stocks. But what we see is the downturns are nowhere near as bad. Here's 2000. Is that 2000? Where's 2000? 2001. You see 2001? 2002? Was it a $100,000 drop? No, it was about a $50,000 drop. And then in 2008, instead of $200,000, we went down to $130,000. But still, it's still not fun because you're in retirement. And the graph is kind of the same, but not as it's not as volatile. So what are your thoughts? Any thoughts? Any comments? Any criticism? So even in retirement, folks, you'll hear people... Yes, Chanel.
Is on the graph, like, is it showing how much you're paying to, like, the mutual fund? Like, don't you have to pay for them to manage?
That's net. It's after the expenses. All whenever you should see a mutual fund return, it has to be... Well, they might show you two. They might show you one that shows what happens if you bought it at NAV, net asset value, and the other one if you paid the maximum sales charge, realizing that you could pay anywhere in between. But they must always show you net of annual operating expenses. So if you buy a no-load fund, you'll just see one number. They must always show you net of the annual operating expenses because they come out before you get paid. Okay? Good question. Okay, questions, thoughts? All right, let's continue because we're almost done. Have I told you about dollar cost? Okay, Daniel, thank you. You can get the lights back up. Cover your eyes, guys. Okay. Have I told you about dollar cost averaging?
Yeah.
I think I have. And the reason I do this is because for most of us working grunts, it's pretty much the only way most of us are going to start investing. Some people say, I want to wait till I have $5,000 or $10,000, then I'll play the market. And I just shake my head and go, good luck. First of all, when is $5,000 going to lie around the house? And it's not going to happen. It's a horrible term. I wish they would come up with a better term, but I've thought about a different term personally, and I can't come up with a better one. A system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount. With dollar cost averaging, you've already seen this, there's always good news. The market's up. Good news. Yippee, because now your account is worth more. But the market's down. Good news. No. Yeah, it is. Next month, you get more shares at a better price, a lower price, when that $50 or $100 comes out of your paycheck or checking account. You don't have to worry about what's the best time to invest. Every month is a good time to have $50 to $100 come out of your paycheck. How much is your cell phone payment? You millennials? What? $85? $140? I can't believe somebody did something to me. Oh, it's $140, but I did. I said, great, fabulous, for one phone. So here is an example. And you can show this one. This is out actually from the Wealthy Barber, but I've seen it in so many different places. You put in $1,000 every year, let's say, just once a year. And the first year, it's $10 a share. So you get 100 shares. 2008 happens, and now it's $5 a share. So you put in your $1,000, and you get 200 shares. Now you have a cumulative 300 shares. The next year, it comes back to $750, and you buy 100 shares at $750. It's 133.333 shares, and mutual funds are in three significant digits. So by looking at this, it looks like you have broken even, right? You bought at 10, 5 and 750. But because you bought fewer shares when the price was high and more shares when the price was low, you actually made money. You did better than break even. Your average cost per share is $6.92. But your average price per share was $7.50. So although it looks like you should have simply broken even, you actually made money because you bought more shares at a lower price. If you look at the value of the shares, $3,250 is what you have. 433.333333 times $7.50. You're at, yes?
If you're buying one stock, though, I mean, isn't that usually going to go up each year?
Each stock?
Yeah, the price of the stock is...
Not necessarily, not if 2008 happens. Well, over time, that's the idea. As the economy expands, as the market improves, as the company builds new products, they pay better dividends. That's what we hope, but we know it's a bumpy ride. So this is what we have to be ready for. And what I want you to memorize, and I know you won't understand what it is, but with dollar cost averaging, your average cost per share should be lower, than your average price per share. And you don't understand what that means, but memorize it. But realize it means that you're buying fewer shares when the price goes high. You're buying more shares when the price goes low. So your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. Is it a guarantee of success? Everyone should say no. Is it a guarantee of success? If the price keeps falling and falling and falling and falling, oh, I'm buying more shares. And when it becomes zero, you can buy an infinite number of shares. Okay. By always investing the same amount of money, you are purchasing more shares when the price is low and fewer shares when the price is high. Your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. However, it is not a guarantee of success. Did I say that already? Dollar cost averaging is not going to help a lousy investment turn a handsome profit. But it does make investing very, very easy. In fact, some might say boring. For mutual fund investors, that is. It's a little bit harder, trickier for stocks and bonds. Because you're going to buy a stock with $50? You can. You can buy one share and pay a $7 commission. But it's better to raise about $700 or $800 and buy 10 shares or 20 shares. You with me? You understand? And then wait until you've gotten your $50 a month, $100 a month, up to about $800 or $900 or $700, and then buy some more shares. That's how many people do it. Make sense? But when you do it in a mutual fund, you know, you buy 25 cents of this, 30 cents of that. Speaking of mutual funds, wasn't diversification one of the two main reasons why so many investors choose mutual funds?
Yes,
the other is professional money management. But does that mean mutual funds necessarily have less risk than individual portfolios or the market as a whole? It depends on the mutual funds. So your assignment for Chapter 11, which is not optional, is to go to Morningstar or finance.yahoo.com and look up five mutual funds. Right, five mutual funds. And I gave you a list of mutual funds that I think are good ones to look at. Here are two of my favorite mutual funds there. And find the links to risk. Check out standard deviation, the correlation coefficient, alpha, beta, what the hell are those things? The trainer, the sharp ratios. Take a look at those if you are so inclined. But there's only a few things I ask you to do. And it's actually pretty straightforward. Mutual funds and concentration. Mutual funds have been noted by many historians. Many market historians have observed the tendency of mutual fund inflows and mutual fund outflows to be a fairly reliable contrarian indicator of market performance. Huh? What does that mean? When people start piling into mutual funds, stock mutual funds we're talking about, these are stock mutual funds, what happens to the market? It's usually it tanks. And when they start piling out of mutual funds, that's the time to buy. So watch what the inflows and the outflows do. And this is the really bizarre part. You know, the market it was destroyed in 2008 and 2009, and that's, you know, textbook, that's the time to buy. Look at the inflows and outflows. As the market was climbing, the people were pulling money out of the stock market through mutual funds. They're pulling money out of their mutual funds. And then, right before 2013, which was one of the best years on record, right? They pulled out a ton of money out of stock mutual funds because of 2011 and 12. 2011 was basically flat. 12 was up a little bit. And yet, now there's still, well, it's, it only goes up to 2012, so we need to get some more information. But, you know, you would think, why don't they take business 123? I don't know. No, they don't. People just sort of listen to their neighbor who's, oh, no, I took all my money out. Maybe I should do this. He took all his money out. Maybe I should do the same. And that is chapter 11. And we are done. We are basically done the entire semester. Well, not really. After exam number 4, we need to take a look at stock options, futures, margining, shorting, things that I hope you never do, but you need to know about. Come on, George. How are you doing, George? Tell us. Come on, tell us.
I'm still about even right now.
About even? Good for you. How long have you been doing it now?
About 2 years.
About 2 years. Good. Usually they lose 30 or 40% a year. Or they lose it all when they just roll the dice and gamble. So, and then we'll also take a look at real estate and other investment alternatives. I have a new schedule for some of you who maybe didn't get it. New schedule of the next few weeks. But these, dear students, are the most popular, most readily available investments, the ones we've done up until today. And then the rest of the semester is scary stuff that you want to stay away from. Except real estate. But we're going to spend a little bit of time on real estate because real estate is a course unto itself. Questions, thoughts, ideas? Okay, now, what do you want to do? Oh, one more quick thing. Let's take a look at those questions again. Hybrid securities, the three things I want you to know about hybrid securities. Preferred stock, the reason it's called preferred is because it has a prior claim to the common shareholders, but is subservient or inferior, junior, to the bondholders. It's in between. That's why it's called preferred. Not because it's preferred over common stock. No, common stock is called common stock because they're shareholders in common, and the common stockholders are the ones who really participate in the success of the company. Many people, many investors call preferred stock bonds, even though they're not. They call them fixed because bonds are fixed and preferred stock is generally fixed. Preferred stock or bonds that can be exchanged for shares of common stock are called convertibles, because you can convert your preferred stock or your bonds into shares of common stock. So it's sometimes called an equity kicker. If the company explodes, you get to share in that as success. And then if you have preferred stock that must be paid dividends in arrears, dividends that they postponed, before they can pay any other preferred stockholders or common stockholders, they must pay you back those dividends. That is called cumulative preferred stock. And I'll use, do you want me to do that? I'll use Blackboard to send you this PDF. If I'll do? Okay, remind me to do that. If I don't do it by tonight, somebody send me an email. Okay, great. Now, we are done. Those of you who want to stick around, my idea is to go through worksheet number 2. Oops, that was a mistake. Worksheet number 2 for bonds. And or we could do a constant perpetual discounted cash flow. Otherwise, if you feel very comfortable about all your calculations, you are free to leave. Make sense? Okay, and David and Steve, you know, don't come today. Okay, good. All right. Worksheet number, who needs worksheet number 1 or 2? I have some extra copies. Okay, they're on the same page. Worksheet number 2 is on the back of worksheet number 1. And my apologies, somebody took green paper in the, I don't usually use green paper. Okay. Anybody need a copy? I got one left. Okay, and as I said, chapter 11, the assignment is the easiest 5 points you'll have all semester long. These are extras. Oh, that's your assignment. Okay, great. Okay, great. Okay. It is optional for you folks in the face-to-face class. Thank you. So what do you think? Did that presentation make sense? Did it tie all together? That was the idea. The tug of war between risk versus return.
What if we came late?
Oh, I'll get you. Who snuck in late? Isaiah, Kenny, Christina, Elizabeth, Vicky, no. Marco, yes. Raul's a Desiree, Victor, no. Isaiah Tapia, he was here. Yeah, he was. Martinique, no. Elizabeth Velasquez, yes. And Jacob, yes. Okay. All right, let's get going. All right, chapter. Okay, that we did worksheet number one. Remember, folks, there is a take care. There's a commentary on the website, an answer key on the website, so you can always go through these over again. So number one, a 7% 30-year bond has a par value of 1,000. Remember, in this class, all bonds will have a par value of 1,000. Some bonds have 5,000 nominations, 10,000. In this class, always 1,000. It is paying 7%. That's how much per year? Everyone just say 70. How much is it paying you per year? $70. Actually, it pays $35 twice a year. But that's the annual interest payment. It is a 30-year bond, so it matures in 30 years. All right. What's the call price? Right. They have to pay us $1,030 if they want to call it away from us. Even though when the bond was originally sold, it was sold at $1,000. If they want to take it back, they got to pay us $1,030. If they let it mature, they only have to pay us $1,000.
So, you're saying if they want to refinance?
If they want to refinance, they have to pay us an extra $30. It's their prepayment penalty. And it is callable in 10 years. So there is a deferred call period, a call protection period. They mean the same thing. A deferred call period or a call protection period of 10 years. So they won't pull it away from us for at least 10 years. What's the market price? So the market now is making us pay $1,060 if we want this bond. So the three questions are calculate the current yield, yield to maturity, and yield to call. First question, what's the nominal yield? What's the coupon yield? Right. What's your name, Bob? So if it's a 7% bond, what's the nominal yield? What's the coupon yield? 7%. Right. They mean the same thing. So what's the current yield? Well, do you have your bond formula? Bond formula sheet? The annual interest in income divided by what we have to pay. What is it paying us right now at this moment if we buy it at this price? So our annual interest on a 7% bond is $70. What's the market price? What's the market price? $10.60. So 70 divided by 10.60 is 0.06666666 or yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. How many? I'm sorry. 6604. I didn't think it was a 66666. Okay. So now you can leave it that way, folks. I won't mark it wrong. Just write down what your calculator writes. But how will it normally be shown? 6.604%. Or you could do 6.60%. We want two or three digits to the right of the decimal point. That's what we normally see. Two is fine. Make sure you round, though, correctly. What's the next number after the four, Elizabeth? 6.0. Okay, okay, good, excellent. Yeah, she did it right. Yeah, so many people at Southwestern students do not know how to round, or they just don't care. You know, they just don't bother. They don't even look at it. You really should, because it makes us look bad, and we can't have that. All right, so that's the current yield. The yield to maturity is that scary looking formula, which is actually not really that hard. You take the annual interest And I like to do the bottom first because that's a little easier, but it's up to you. You take the par value, the face value, they mean the same thing, plus the market price, and divide that by two. Well, all that is the average. That's just the average of the two of them. Because we had to pay the market price, but we're going to get the par value back. So up here, you see the annual interest divided by the market price. Well, we paid the market price, but we're going to get the par value back. And then this bad boy over here says, take the par value, subtract the market value, market price, and divide by the number of years to maturity. So what is this guy doing? It is simply taking into account the fact that we are not going to get the market price when the bond matures. We're going to get the par value. So whether we buy it at a discount and move up to 1,000 or buy it at a premium and move down to 1,000, this will essentially add or subtract a certain amount every year to get us there. So it's like we get an extra $5 a year or subtract an extra $7 a year. Make sense? Okay, so let's do them one at a time. What I've noticed is I don't normally do this, but some people, especially the online students, they have a tendency not to do this first. They don't realize that you have to divide before you add. Sometimes what they'll do is they'll do this, they'll add this to that and subtract that and then divide. No, don't do that. Okay, so maybe I should put a, you gotta divide first because addition and division, they're not commutative. So what's the par value?
1,000.
What's the market price? 1,060. So 1,000 plus 1,060 is 2,060 divided by 2, 1,030. And some of you could do that in your head. I'm not suggesting you do. But what's the midpoint between 1,000 and 1,060? 1,030. Yeah, 1,030. Okay. And now, par value is 1,000 minus the market value of 1,060. That's a negative 60. It's going to go down $60. And how long is it going to take it to go down $60? 30 years. So negative 60 divided by 30 is a tough question, folks. 60 divided by 30 is 2. And it's negative, so it's a negative 2. So every year, the bond's value, theoretically, now it changes as interest rates change. And, of course, if the bond is thought to be in distress, it'll fall precipitously. But every year, we're essentially going to knock $2 off the price of the bond. So we have the annual interest of $70 plus a minus 2. 70 plus a minus 2 is 68. Are we going too fast, George? Going a little too fast? Yeah, okay. What, have you been to the Academic Success Center with the math tutors? Okay, show them this. And you come out there. I got some time. I wanted to go down and check the pottery though, but I got some time after class. Yes. It's always 1,000. Yeah, just assume it's always 1,000. Yeah, I apologize. On the assignment sheet, I didn't put a par value. Dummy. Yeah, just always assume 1,000. There are some bonds, some muni bonds that are 5 and 10,000. Treasury bills used to be in $10,000 increments, but just always assume it's 1,000. Okay, now that is 68 divided by 1030 or 0.0661. So essentially the same as this guy up here, isn't it? Very, very close. But there's just a little bit of difference. This one's a little bit higher, and that's because it's a 30-year bond. Okay, All right, now the yield to call is essentially the same. Now, where's my green?
Where's my other color?
Yeah, well, over there. Look for it. I didn't see it.
Aha, here they are. It's essentially the same formula. We take the
wrong color.
We take the annual interest and we divide it by, but instead of the, what we do is we replace the par value with the call value. The call price or call value plus the market price divided by 2. And then over here, instead of the par value, we use the call value. And then we still use market price. But instead of dividing it by the number of years of maturity, we divide it by the number of years to the call. So the only two numbers that change are the par value, which changes to the call price, and the number of years of maturity changes the number of years of call. So $70. What's the call price? $10.30 plus $10.60 is $2,090 divided by 2, $10.45. And some of you can do that in your head. What's the midpoint between 30 and 60? It's 45. But you don't have, that's why you got calculators. What's the call value? Call price? $10.30. Market price is $10.60. So 10.30 minus 10.60 is a minus 30. So that means between now and when it is called, we're going to lose $30. And we divide that by a number of years to call. What's the call protection period for? 10 years. 30 divided by 10 is a negative 3. So we take 70 plus a negative 3, or, right, 67 divided by 10.45, 1140, okay. So 6.41% would be fine, or just show what your calculator says, it's good enough. Questions, thoughts, ideas, comments, criticism. Remember, the answer key is on the website, too. So if you go to the Academic Success Center, just point them to the website. They'll see the answer key if they have any questions. Okay, number 2. All right. A married couple from California is in the federal tax bracket, 35%. They're making $300,000. They come to you. And they say, we want to take a look at 3 different bonds. What's the California bracket? 11%. Sure. See you Thursday. So they're in the 35% federal tax bracket, 11% California, and they're looking at 3 different bonds. The first bond is a 6% Arizona. The second bond is a 5.5% California. See you, Adam. California, and the 3rd percent is an 8% corporate bond. Can we make a decision about these 3 bonds? Before we decide, we need to know what's the taxable equivalent yield. So do we do any calculation whatsoever for the corporate bond? No. If you do a calculation for the corporate bond, what do you get? Zabapo. Dope slap. Don't do it. Don't make a calculation that it is already fully taxable. Now, the Arizona bond, it's a California couple. Do they pay federal income taxes? No. Muni bonds are not taxable at the federal level.
no matter where you buy them. Right now, there's some Puerto Rico bonds that are paying 10, 11%. But people, you gotta, because that could be a real disaster. Puerto Rico is the Greece of the United States. Okay, so it is federal tax free. But can California, can they tax Arizona? Oh yeah, and they do. So it is only federal tax free. But what about the California bond? Is it federal free?
Yeah.
All muni bonds are federal free. So is the California bond federal free?
Yeah.
But they're a California couple. And the state of California says to them, says, cool, you're a California taxpayer. You're buying a California municipal bond. We won't charge you interest. I mean income tax on your interest. So you're going to get paid interest, but you're not going to get charged income tax. So it is Fed and state tax-free. And remember, the IRS doesn't like that term tax-free. They want to use tax-exempt. They don't never want you to use the word free. That's a joke. All right, sorry. All right, so what formula do we use? Do you have your formula sheet? What formula do we use for the Arizona bond? Do you have the formula sheet? Taxable equivalent yield, federal only. Excellent. Do you have the chapter 11? I mean, chapter 8, do you have the corporate? You don't have those things. Okay. So what's the formula? The muni bond yield.
Divided by 1.0 minus federal marginal tax bracket.
The muni bond yield divided by the federal marginal tax rate. So what's the muni bond yield for the Arizona bond?
6%
divided by 1.0 minus, what's the federal tax rate? 35%. And we don't type 6%, 35% in our calculator. What's 6%? 0.06. What's 35%? 0.35. So 1 minus 0.35 is
0.65.
Is that what you got, George? Okay. Okay. So 0.06 divided by 0.65 is 0.09. 0.07. Wow. That's pretty darn good. 9.23%. You can write, or you could write the whole thing out. Doesn't matter. So right off the bat, we know the Arizona bond is pretty darn good, isn't it? Is that what you got, George?
Yeah.
All right. Now, what's the formula for the federal and state?
Muni bond yield. Divided by
this scary puppy here. It's going to fall. It's not that hard. 1 minus 0 divided by the quantity. The federal rate, right, plus the quantity state rate times 1, the quantity 1 minus the federal rate. So it looks like it should be from the Department of Redundancy Department, but there's a reason for that. Most people who are in this tax bracket are itemizing their deductions on their Schedule A, their Form 1040 Schedule A. Which means they have a huge house, huge mortgage interest payments, and they get to deduct their state income taxes. So if we don't include that, what we're saying is they're not itemizing. And if you happen to find, or if you're in this situation where you're making a lot of money and you don't have a huge mortgage payment, then you would get rid of this term and you just do Fed rate plus state plus Fed rate plus the state rate. But that's unusual. That doesn't happen. In the 121 class, we ignore that because I just don't want to get into it. And they're not going to become stockbrokers. But here, we do need to do it right. So the muni bond yield is for the California? So how do I write that? It's 5.5%, but how do I write it? I don't type that in my calculator. I write 0.055. Because, and if you have trouble with that, George, if you have trouble with that, just do 1 divided by 2. You see this guy right here? If you do 1 divided by 2, you'll see it's 0.5. One half is 0.5, one quarter is 0.25, three quarters is 0.75. Just do it on your calculator and it'll make sense. Okay, now, the federal rate is 35%, the state rate is 11%, the federal rate is 35%. We write 0.35, 0.11, 0.35. Well, now let's do it starting from the middle. One minus 0.35. Again, same thing up here. What is that? Right. George, 1 minus 0.35. Do you see the pattern? Is 0.65. And then what you do is a 0.11 times 0.65. Careful, 0.0715. Yeah. Make sure you get the decimal point there in the right place. Good job, Basta. So now, 0.35 plus 0.0715. If everybody gets that. Is that what you got, Isaiah?
I'm not really understanding it, so I'm just copying it.
Oh, okay, okay. Remember, there's a commentary. What aren't you understanding? Just go like this. Go help. Where did we lose you?
In the beginning.
In the beginning. Okay.
It's all good. Just keep going.
The muni bond yields are not taxable equivalent to the corporate bond. So if you look at those two numbers, 6 and 5.5%, it looks like the corporate bond is paying more. But we're not comparing apples to apples. We're comparing apples to grapefruit. We've got to turn those muni bond yields into taxable equivalent. Because after we've done, notice, this is a whole lot better than 8%, isn't it? So on an after-tax basis, that Arizona bond is a lot better deal than the corporate bond. Right. And now we're doing the same calculation, but now we're doing the calculation for California. So did you get 0.4215, George?
Yeah.
Okay, now don't forget the 1 minus. So 1 minus 0.4215. Elizabeth says 0.5785. And it looks really scary, all the work we did, but we just started from the middle and the most innermost parentheses and worked our way out. So you just got to stay organized. So did you get 0.5785?
I got 9.5785.
Okay, you might have fat-fingered it. Try it again. 1.0 minus 0.4215. You need a calculator bigger bigger digits.
Yeah.
Right? Right. So now that thing goes up to here, and we take this over there. I know it looks scary, but got to get organized. 0.055 divided by 0.5785 gives us a taxable equivalent yield that looks pretty darn good. 0.9507 or 9.51%. So it turns out that the California bond is the best deal out of the three. Assuming they're all the same credit quality and they're not none of them are in danger of defaulting. 0.5785 gives you
0.5507.
Is that what you got?
Yeah.
Cool. So it just takes you a little longer. Just gotta. Make sense? No or yes or no? Okay. It just, George, you might want to, you sure you don't want to take the exam with the proctor and take a whole lot more time? Well, it's not too late. I'll talk to Carol. But I'm sticking around here, right, after class. So I'll stick around for another hour. So it's up to you. But you just, you know, you're a little slow, which is okay. And you really, I got a calculator bigger, but you really, you could get one of these ones that have buttons like this. Because, you know, you need, those tiny little things are not that good for you. Okay, so now let's do number three. I got a little bit of room here. I'm going to, you have the thing in front of you, so I'm going to turn this off. Okay. All right, so number three is our bond valuation. A. What is this bond? A, 3A.
8%
20-year bond.
Price to yield
5%. Price, bald. Price to yield 5%. So, we're always $1,000. We assume always $1,000. Now, we bought it, it was paying us 8%, but now yields have gone down to 5%. So what should we expect the price to be? Above 1,000 or below 1,000? Interest rates are falling. That's okay. We should expect when interest rates fall, what happened to bond prices? They go up. So we should expect what? We should expect a premium bond. Interest rates fall, prices rise, so we should expect a bond paying more, or not paying, but a bond that's priced more than 1,000. So how does this work? The formula is the value of the bond is equal to the present value, and I like to write PV, because it reminds me of Puerto Vallarta, of the income from the interest, plus the present value of the principal repayment. We're going to get payments of interest from this bond for the next 20 years, and then we're going to get our principal back. And what we need to do is take that future stream of income and,
Good, yeah.
We're going to take that future stream of interest income and that principal repayment and bring it back to the present by using the present value multipliers. So on the back of the formula sheet are the two formulas, two tables that you're going to use. Are you with me? Understand? Now, what interest are we getting from an 8% bond? $80, right. That's what we're going to get on the payment of the bond value. But on the $1,000, we're always going to get $80. And how do we bring that $80 payment that we're going to get for the next 20 years, how do we bring that back to the present? We use the present value table on the left. Present value of a dollar, stream of payments. So go across to 8% or 5%. No. Yes. It's price to yield 5%, so we use the 5%. If you go ahead and do it for 8%, and what you'll find is you get $1,000. Because if it's an 8% bond, price to yield 8%, it'll be $1,000. Yes, at 20 years, and you go down 20 years, and what's the multiplier? 12.462. And then what we add to that is the principal repayment. Well, how much are we going to get back when the bond matures? Cricket? How much are we going to get back when the bond matures? What are we going to get back when the bond matures? We're going to get the $1,000 back. How much are we going to get back when the bond matures? What's the principal? $1,000. Everyone should say $1,000. What are we going to get? Wait till I ask you. What are we going to get back when the bond matures? $1,000. But what is that $1,000 worth to us today? Well, it's a single payment, which means we use the table on the right, and it's price to yield 5%. So we go across the 5% down to 20 years. The table on the right is a single payment. We're only going to get $1,000 once, folks. They ain't going to give us $1,000 every year. Wouldn't that be nice? 0.377? Is that what you got? So now we simply do the multiplications. 80 times 12.462. And 1,000 times 0.377. David says that the first calculation is 996.96. So that $80 a year for the next 20 years is worth to us today $996.96. The second one, many of you can do that in your head because it's always 1,000 times 0.377 or whatever the number is. You just move the decimal place three to the right. But it's up to you if you want to do that. Use your calculator. So 377. See, that second one is easy to do. George, you understand that?
Yeah.
Okay. And Betsy, she's on something else. Okay. That's okay. So you add these two numbers together, and this bond should be selling for approximately
$1,373.96.
Almost $1,400. And we saw that. Those Ford bonds that were paying 9%, 8%, and yielding 4%, and they were selling for $1,400. And some of them are not maturing until 2097. Boy, I'm sure Ford is kicking themselves for that one. Pay those bonds for the whole 21st century. Okay. Is it a premium bond? Yes, it's above 1,000. Now, 3B. Wait a minute, let's make sure George is with us here. Make sense? Okay, so now a 6% bond, well, how many years? 10-year, price to yield. Ah, what's happened to interest rates? They've gone up, haven't they? So what should we expect, a premium or a discount bond? We should expect a discount bond. Interest rates have gone up, bond prices go down. Right? All right, so the same formula applies.
present value of the interest income plus, look at that, that's a funny looking T, plus the present value of the principal repayment . So, what interest are we getting on a 6% bond?
$60.
How many years? At price to yield what?
9%.
Price to yield 9%. So, go across 9% on the table. Which table do we use? The one on the right, the first table. And then go down to 10 years.
6.418.
Elizabeth says 6.418. Is she right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then we add to that the fact that how much are we going to get when the bond matures?
$1,000.
And that one payment of $1,000 in 10 years is worth to us how much? Go across to 9% down 10 years,
0.422.
Did you get that?
Times 0.422.
Did you see that on the graph?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. So some of you can do this in your head. 1,000 times 422 is $422. Just move the decimal point three to the right. 60 times 6.418.
3508.
3508, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you do one of this from chapter 11,
correct?
It's a bond price to you.
This chapter 10?
Yeah.
Right, that's what we're doing right now. We're doing worksheet number 2.
Okay. No,
the last two you're talking about. Okay, what I want you to do first, the number 9 and number 10,
yeah.
I want you to get in there in chapter 9 and find out what a zero coupon bond is. Got to understand what a zero coupon bond is.
Oh.
What is a zero coupon bond? It doesn't pay any interest. So, think about it. Let's finish up this one first. So, 350.80 plus 422? 385.08. Whoa! What? Oh, I'm sorry. 385.08. I apologize. I got wax in my ears. Or something in my ears. I can't hear you. I got banana in my ear. 385.08, says George. Yeah? Okay.
Yes.
So plus the 422, 800. 807.08. So $800, $807. It's fallen from 1,000 to 807.08.
I have a question.
Sure.
Where did you get the 422 from?
Okay. It's a one-time payment. So which table do we use? The one on the left or the one on the right? The left. See? Of a lump sum payment. This is the one we use for the interest income. This is the one we use for the principal repayment. So go across do we go across to 6 or 9%? Price to yield. That's the one we use. So go across 6%. Go across the 9%. Go across the 9% and then down to 10 years. Make sense?
Yeah.
And of course, we have spreadsheets to do this for us. You might have missed that presentation where we saw the Pred spreadsheet did it. You know, bing, you just typed in the amount and boom, it calculates it immediately. But this is all we have in the class. All right, questions, thoughts? All right, now, Betsy, what's different between a zero coupon bond? Chapter 9 will tell you that zero coupon bonds do not pay any interest.
Oh, okay.
So if it doesn't pay any interest, what's the present value of zero?
Zero.
Right? In other words, if you ain't going to get any interest income, it ain't worth anything. It's worth zero. Well, you don't do this side, but are you still going to get your $1,000 back? You see, here's how a zero coupon bond works. Normally, you buy a bond for $1,000. You get your interest. And then when the bond matures, you get your $1,000. All right? A zero coupon bond works very differently. You buy the bond for, say, $300. And you get no interest for 20 years. And then you get $1,000 back. You see, so what happens is the bond accrues value. I don't know if you like that word, but that's the word we use. The word is accrue, which means it gathers value, accumulates value, it grows. Does that make sense? So are you getting any interest? No. But the value, as the bond gets closer and closer, the value goes up from 300 to 500 to 700 to 800 to 1,000. Now here's the kicker. The IRS wants you to pay taxes on that accrual. They don't want you to wait until it's 1,000 and then pay them all at one time. They want you to pay income tax on the phantom income that you're not receiving. What a bad deal that is, right? So what often they do is people will put them into a retirement account, which is tax deferred. Or they'll buy muni bonds, which are zero coupon bonds, because muni bonds are not taxable. Does that make sense?
So do we do the same as
you do the same here, but what happens to this? What happens to this guy?
Because you just have 10 years and 5%, so
we just use that. You just use that one. That's right. Because this one is zero. Right.
And for 10, it's the same?
No, 10's a little different.
Yeah.
What do they do? What do they do?
It has 20 years, zero coupon, and it's 10 guys up to.
So what they're doing there is they're giving you the price, and you have to work backwards and get the interest rate.
On that, in that percent.
How many years is it? Betsy, I want you to think about it for 4 minutes and 17 seconds. Okay? Think about it. Look at the problem and what's the hint? The hint. ¿Cómo se dice hint in Espanol? The clue.
Yeah.
¿Cómo se dice?
Yeah. Clue is the same in Spanish.
Oh, clue? Yeah. Pero escribe C-L-U? Okay. So what's the clue? No. What's the clue?
Oh, think backwards.
Think backwards. Think, in other words, what did you do here? And then reverse the process. Think about it for 4 minutes and 37 seconds.
So I go 20 years, and then...
Betsy, I want you to think about it. Yes, you're on the right track. Betsy, I want you to think about it. I want you to do it. You're a big girl now. Okay, I'm going to erase this or keep it on the board? I'll keep it on the board for now. Okay? All right. Whew! You can do it, Betsy. I know you can. I have faith in you. I'm tired. Oh, there's Elizabeth. Sorry. How'd you do?
Okay, well, these are 121.
That's
so
good. That's good. Stapler. Okay. Excellent.
Can I have another one of these? I'm going to redo.
Which one? Yeah, here. Can I have another one? No, that was my last one. But if you come to my office, I'll give you another one.
Can you show me?
Mr.
Payano. Yeah?
What's a penny stock?
Okay, tell your boyfriend to take Business 123, or at least go on the website under Chapter 5, and you'll see examples of penny stocks. They're frauds. Trucos, travesuras. No son verdaderos. No son empresas verdaderas.
Oh, okay.
¿Entiendes?
Yeah, can people send videos on YouTube? And he was like, oh, I'm going to do it. And I told him, I was taking your class. And he was like, oh, I'll
No, tell them it's gambling. We don't use the word gambling. We use the word speculating, but it's the same thing. He's rolling the dice, and he's basically going to Vegas, and you know when you go to Vegas, you're going to lose. The casinos are not in business to lose money. They're in business to make money. And the same thing is true here. He's basically betting against sharks who have all the cards and know how to cheat, and he's hoping to play with these people. There's a saying in the gambling world. If you don't know who the patsy is at the poker table, then it's probably you. You understand? So ask him to go to chapter 5 of Business 123 and look at some examples of the penny stocks. I know what he saw. I see them too. Betsy, tell him to contact me. No, he's going to lose his money. Tell him Vegas is more fun. Okay? Yeah. Okay, yes, George. Number one, and worksheet number? Do number one again?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you bye-bye. Come to my office, okay? Okay, because I got to get him another copy. Oh. All right. Here's the assignment sheets. Where is he? Okay, this stays here, this goes there, take this. I'm sorry, say that again? Because bonds are a very important part of the investment world. Well, that's not all. You got to know if... Yeah, no, you got to know their credit rating. Well, that's why we do the calculations, to know what rates they're paying. But you're absolutely right. You learn the price-to-earnings formula... But then when you go look at a stock, do you calculate it? No, it's right there on the screen. You learn the formulas to do yield to maturity, current yield, but then when you look at a bond, do you need to calculate it? No, because it's right there on the screen when you look it up. I apologize, but you got to learn it anyway. Because you have to understand what the hell you're looking at. Does that make sense? Okay, thank you. That kind of drives it up. Yes, it is.